Brigadier Gregory, Reel 2.
On the next day, the Australians continued the advance on the right and secured 812 without opposition. On the left, the boarders, under mortar and sniper fire, fought their way forward along a spur leading up to 432, while the 2nd PPCLI, the Canadians, protected their rear and left flank. At this stage, the American infantry on our right were making good progress over the more favourable country. But 25th United States Division on the left were some 2,000 yards behind us. It was pouring with rain, and the anti-tank mines on the lateral road caused losses to men and vehicles and increased the difficulties from a supply point of view. Communications with the 1st King's Shropshire Light Infantry broke down. It was difficult to know exactly where they were, and that they were moving over the mountains behind the 3rd Royal Australians.
They were what, sorry?
Moving over the mountains behind the 3rd Royal Australians. I therefore went forward with my escort to find them. I suppose it was at some risk. It was very lonely, but I did find them, and that was all right. On the third day, the 1st King's Own Scottish Borders had a long and gallant struggle for 432. This proved to be a real rock fortress, and a veritable rabbit warren for the Chinese defenders. One platoon of D Company actually succeeded in getting onto the objective, but it was counterattacked by the enemy in company strength. Being very short of ammunition, the company commander, Major Alistair McKenzie, pulled it back slightly. A turning movement was mounted by another company, and airstrikes were put in. About this time I went forward to see Alistair and discuss what could be done.
What kind of condition were they in when you got there?
Oh, they were in good form. Oh, yes. Good steady form, you know. Not worried in any way, really. A turning movement was mounted by another company and airstrikes were put in, but by now it was judged that we should go firm for the night. This fighting was often at close quarters, and the New Zealand OP officers said that our men fought well up to the standard of the infantry of the New Zealand division in the last war, which was a great tribute, because they were second to none. Next morning, the enemy had again faded mysteriously, and our advance continued. The border had suffered 14 casualties, and so far had inflicted approximately 30 or 40 on the enemy. For the next 2 days, we continued to push forward over rugged country against little opposition. These little actions, in which we suffered some casualties, are the typical of the enemy tactics in retreat. The small parties he leave behind are both determined and brave. He digs himself in extremely well, makes good use of the boulders which the hills are strewn with, digging away most of the earth beneath them and leaving only the smallest aperture. In this way, he made himself impervious to artillery and air fire and air strikes and small arms. Flamethrowers would have been useful, but portage up the steep and rocky hills would have been a hazardous business. Almost all the features had a razor-edged line behind which the enemy hides himself. So positioned, he is unassailable by artillery and perfectly positioned for any immediate counterattack. To consider the larger picture for a moment, it is interesting to note the attacks against the brigade's positions never in full strength never materialized. Although there was quite a build-up in front and quite heavy probing on the flanks, it would seem that he intended no more than to contain us on this west central front, while the weight of his effort was put in on the east flank. Why he left us severely alone remains something of a mystery. General opinion here is that our positions were too strong and that he had no wish to face them. In The enemy is now in full-scale flight, although his attacks in the east have been contained, and the Allied counterattacks in the west have trapped him hopelessly. The enemy suffered extremely heavy casualties. The first time in the campaign, we captured large numbers of Chinese prisoners. After being in the spearhead of the advance, the 28th Brigade was now relieved in the line. In this opportune moment, the 2nd Princess Pat's Canadian Light Infantry left us to join the newly arrived 25th Canadian Infantry Brigade in their assembly area. We were very sorry indeed when the Canadians left us after such a happy association. They were commanded by a very fine commanding officer, Colonel Stone, a veteran of World War II. On the 28th of May, we received a warning order from the Corps, prepared to move at midday on the 29th to the 1st Corps sector, Lieutenant General Milburn. We find to be a very nice man, good general. He had played American football for the American Army. We would occupy positions along the Imjin River on the right of the 29th British Brigade with the 25th Canadian Brigade in reserve. This was the beginning of the formation of the 1st Commonwealth Division. By the 30th of May, the move-up had been effected and the battalions were occupied in the new forward-defended localities in the pouring rain. From now on, we were under command of the 1st Cavalry, United States Cavalry Division, Major General Palmer, an excellent soldier. We relieved his troops in the line in order that behind our defensive positions he would prepare for a new offensive within the next week. The divisional commander ordered us to commence patrolling forward to a depth of 6,900 yards over the Imjin River. Thus we would completely dominate our immediate front. On the 1st of June, patrols from the light infantry attempted a river crossing supported by the tanks of the 8th Royal Irish Hussars, Lieutenant Colonel Sir William Lowther, Bart. However, the current was very strong, and by 16:25 for 5 hours, only two platoons had managed to cross under small arms fire. The tanks became hopelessly bogged down in the mud, and I ordered that no more infantry would attempt the crossing that day. The two platoons that crossed were able to pinpoint enemy outposts, which our artillery promptly engaged. Then the patrol began to withdraw. They received heavy and accurate mortar fire as they broke contact. This caused 10 casualties, including the company commander, Major Evans, a most gallant officer, and one other officer. It was now apparent that a bridgehead would have to be secured over the Imjin River before patrols could be operated successfully. An assault river crossing was planned, and therefore the Canadians again came under command for that operation. The 3rd Royal Australians were to cross the river first light on the 4th of June and secure the perimeter, which the Canadians would pass through in order to attack Hill 194. Once we had secured this feature, we were able to patrol at will from a secure base over the river. However, on the next day, heavy thunderstorms burst over the whole area and the river rose considerably during the night. The crossing was unavoidably postponed, but later in the day, after reconnaissance by the engineers, a better site was selected, some 3,000 yards further to the north. This operation was planned for 6th of June to be carried out by 2 companies of the Canadians, and as soon as they were over, the engineers would follow and construct a Class 50 bridge. On completion of the bridge, 2 armoured task forces, each consisting of 1 Australian company and a troop of tanks, the detachment of engineers were to cross the river and patrol forward past the firm base on the southwest and northwest routes. Initially, the operation went well. Once again, the enemy mysteriously faded. When the work started on the bridges, the engineers received mortar fire, which delayed the work. In fact, They were American engineers. And it was rather embarrassing because they got in their lorries and departed. I had to get onto the American Corps commando, and it was very awkward. And he was very cross with his own men, and they were sent back to do the job. The two task forces had been waiting for, then crossed and patrolled forward aggressively in what little time was left that day. Similar patrols from all battalions in turns operated daily until after the first week the use of armour was discontinued. At first we encountered fire from scattered machine gun and mortar positions, but gradually those groups were mopped up and soon the patrols were reduced in strength. The brigade was therefore fulfilling several vital roles. Firstly, it was holding a sector approximately 12,000 yards long on the south and eastern flanks of the Imogen. The positions which had been mined and wired continually for...
The what had been mined and wired?
The positions which had been mined and wired continually for almost 6 weeks were extremely strong. All types of fire and supporting weapons had been coordinated along the entire front. Secondly, the brigade now dominated the ground north of the river to a depth of 6,000 yards. This was achieved by establishing firm patrol bases in no man's land by the Bridgehead Battalion. The location of this particular battalion meant that the brigade had no immediate reserve, but on the other hand, this battalion was carrying out the threefold role of manning the firm bases, protecting the bridge itself, and also protecting the left flank of the 1st Cavalry Division, which had now executed their limited offensive and patrolling forward from the line. From the line Wyong, W-Y-O-N-I-N-G.
Is that Wyoming?
Wyoming, I suppose it's American. In the event of any real Chinese threat, the cavalry were to withdraw to the line Kansas. And the Bridgehead Battalion would then immediately change its role and withdraw into Brigade Reserve. There it would become available for deployment into previously prepared positions. Also, it would have been available in part for the prearranged tank and infantry counterattacks. On the 11th of June, the Princess Pats were relieved in the bridgehead by the French Canadians of the Royal 22nd Regiment under Lieutenant Colonel Dextraz, D-E-X-T-R-A-Z-E, D-S-O. I had known him in the fighting in Holland in 1944 during the Second World War. A very young CO he was, I think about 24, now he was about 38. And he was a very fine... very, very fine battalion commander. Never bellyached, always got on with the job. Believed like Nelson, he couldn't do wrong by closing with the enemy. Which was my motto also. Later on the 18th of July, at the KSLI, and now a new CO, Colonel Barlow, were in turn relieved the French Canadians when the Canadian Brigade was required intact in another sector. The 3rd Royal Australians, who had been resting in Brigade Reserve, then took over the positions from which the Light Infantry held on the Imogen River. Patrolling continued along the whole front. We are now waiting news from the Kansong, K-A-K-S-O-N-G, where representatives of both sides were meeting to discuss a ceasefire. However,
you talked about the large numbers of Chinese prisoners which were taken. In what kind of physical condition were they?
They were all right. They were well fed, obviously. They hadn't collapsed for lack of food or anything like that.
What about their demeanour? Were they passive or defiant or what?
Passive, definitely. Definitely. Not defiant. Definitely passive. As most prisoners are, in my experience.
Did any of them decide to defect?
Well, I wouldn't know that because there was a great deal of trouble later on. When they became, they were organized in the big prison camps. in Korea later on, there was a lot of trouble, but that was they weren't like that when they surrendered.
You didn't have any personal contact with
the trouble later? No.
Were they just Chinese, or were there any North Koreans?
They were all Chinese, as far as I know.
What impression did you get of their equipment, their clothing and weapons?
Their clothing was all right, but their weapons were adequate and small arms. They had these burp guns, light machine guns and mortars, and not much artillery, fortunately.
What was your impression of them as a fighting force, the enemy?
They were hardy and brave. Couldn't be sneezed at by any means, and given to the method of night attacks in mass. And for this reason, I advocated very strongly that each section should have two Bren guns instead of one, two light automatics instead of one. I had a little difficulty in selling this to some of the battalion commanders, not all. They said that, we're going to carry them, sir. Where are we going to carry them? I said, well, damn it all. You don't need to carry them very much. If you're occupying a defensive position, they can be ferried up. And if you move into the attack, you can leave them behind, and then they can be ferried up later on. That was accepted. And they proved their worth, very much so, later on in the campaign. And nowadays, of course, the British infantry section has two light machine guns, which is one of the lessons of the Falklands War. We have to relearn these lessons by fresh wars, it seems.
So the strong points of the Chinese, you said, was their hardihood.
Yeah, that's right.
And bravery. What were their weak points?
I think that they were not very skilled, and the tactics were not very skilled. That's all you could say, really. I don't suppose their officers were anything up to our standards.
Did you capture many officers, or were they mostly other ranks?
Mostly other ranks, yeah. Only a few officers, very few.
You've talked about the use of air power. How decisive do you think that this was?
I would say that it played a very necessary part. Both in reconnaissance and hindering to some extent the line of communications of the Chinese. But it wasn't I remember an RAF officer, high-ranking officer, I've forgotten his name now, he came out and he was a bit critical of the policy, which was in American hands. I don't know whether he was right or not, of trying to block the Chinese, disrupt the Chinese communications, the methods used. I mean, it's so long ago, I can't remember the actual details. Why?
For example, do you think the counterattack, which you described in May 1951, could have gone ahead without, if you hadn't had the backing of the air arm?
I think so, yes. Oh yes, it was mainly mainly operated against the at this stage anyway mainly against the Chinese line of communications way back towards the Manchurian frontier. We didn't see much of the Air Force. We knew they were there, glad of them. Now let me see, what's that?
Did you see the aircraft using napalm?
Later on, not at this stage.
You talked about the Republic of Korea units.
Yeah.
Were they a weak link, or were they just as reliable as the other Allied forces?
Oh, no. Well, I understand there were one or two divisions that were exceptional, but on the whole, they were not as good as the British or the Americans or the Canadians. They had American officers attached to them.
Did the Chinese tend...
But the Koreans are very brave people, and we had the Chinese, we had Korean porters, who were gutsy little men. Even under fire, they were trying to do their job to the best of their ability. Nothing but praise for them.
Was there any tendency of the Chinese to concentrate their men pressure against the ROK units?
Yes, I suppose they were. Yes, I suppose they did when they could locate them.
Were you aware of which particular Chinese units you were facing? Did you have that kind of intelligence?
Oh, yes, we had quite a lot. We had almost too much intelligence. I used to read the American reports very closely, but they never came down decisively in their reports that this is probably will happen, or they didn't give sort of priorities, likely priorities. So it was difficult to use that intelligence in a way. It was very general.
When you say you had almost too much intelligence, do you mean too much to absorb in the time?
That's right.
How did the different nationalities in the Commonwealth Brigade cooperate with each other?
Well, the first thing to say, except for the French, who were very good, they were all British. They were all British stock, so there wasn't any particular problem. Rather amusingly, when the Canadians were marching past the Aussies said, "The trouble with you, so-and-so, is you live too near the Americans." But that was only fun. No, they got on extremely well. It was extremely good spirit.
So was there no real tension between the Australians and the Canadians?
No. That was a joke. Oh, yeah, it was a marvellous. Marvellous brigade. Marvellous.
Just
I would say it was probably at that time, or shortly afterwards, the most efficient brigade in the Commonwealth, because the British have been extremely well trained, hard trained, because we were facing the Chinese in Hong Kong. It was realistic training, and then we had all these small operations. And very light casualties. Very light casualties. Well, let's go on, because a lot more.
No.
At the end of July in 1951, the three British and Commonwealth brigades became the British Commonwealth Division. We then located behind the Imjin River, near where the Gloucesters fought their epic battle. There were a number of doubts expressed in my brigade about the conduct of this action. I therefore decided to hold a battlefield tour, which included officers of my brigade and the 29th Brigade. And it was very enlightening, and we all came to the conclusion that the British Brigade, and in particular Gloucesters, had fought extremely well. In August, at the end of the rain, it was the end of the rainy season. The river water levels fell, and the division moved forward with a minimum fuss and bother. And the road net was built by the engineers towards the enemy positions without any interference, strangely enough. Suddenly the Commonwealth Division was called upon to take part in a core attack in which three divisions were to be used. On the left, the Commonwealth Division, In the centre, the 1st Cavalry Division, but they were infantry, converted to infantry, United States, and the 3rd United States Division on the extreme right. Object to clear the enemy from the railway, our railway communications, which would improve the logistics situation, and capture high ground to make it more difficult for the enemy to mount any large offensive. And thirdly, to inflict maximum losses. The divisional plan was phase 1, the 3rd of October, phase 2, the 4th of October, and phase 3, the 5th of October. On the 3rd of October, we were to capture 355, which looked rather like the Rock of Gibraltar, and then to attack and capture Hill 1187, and finally 317. The division only had 2 brigades, as 29 brigades were in process of being relieved by fresh personnel. We were supported by the divisional artillery and howitzers, American howitzers from the Corps. It consisted of long toms, and of course we had a lot of 4.2 mortars. In all, we had about 120 pieces of artillery and more heavy mortars. When the brigade planning started, we did not know much about the enemy. But with their photos and the help of the divisional intelligence, we built up a picture of the enemy. The 65th Chinese Army, which was really a corps, had one division forward opposing us and 2 divisions in reserve. The 191 division had 1 regiment right of the road and 1 left and 1 in reserve. Their positions were well camouflaged, deep dugouts, bunkers and trenches. The latter, strangely enough, often were run in straight lines, which made them easy to outflank or overrun. The Chinese had plenty of small arms and mortars and more artillery than we thought he had, as it proved. We were able to locate many of the company positions. We were also by patrolling and air photographs. We also found out that point 199 was only held by a section, which I was able to take advantage of. It gave us room to manoeuvre and exert leverage. The brigade plan, 28th Cavalry Brigade plan, the King's Own Scottish Borderers were to attack 355.